Nick, welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Show. Nice to have you here.
Dude, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes, you're a guy I've been wanting to talk to for a long time. Ever since I read your first book, Layered Money. That is your first book, right? At least your first Bitcoin book. I found that to be great. I mean, like all Bitcoin books, like the more Bitcoin books there are, the more repetitive they get. But this was one that I read pretty early on, so I hadn't gotten like bored with Bitcoin books yet, and it's a very good companion to the other books because it talked about money evolving in layers, I just love that framing. But this is the first time you've been on this show, so why don't you give our listeners a little TLDR on Nick Bhatia and who you are, where you're coming from, and where you're going.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I'm California born. My parents came to the United States from India. My grandfather moved our family from India. So a strong connection with the country. My wife is also from there. But I'm through and through an American and a very strong California identity, actually, I would say, as well. I went to university here in Southern California at USC. And then I went to Spain to study finance. And I got a master's degree in Europe. I came back, worked for a hedge fund in fixed income. I was a, you can call it middle office paper pusher, but it's very small shop. So I got to do and see very front office level of portfolio management at a hedge fund, high level institutional clients. And then I moved on and got a job as a bond trader, traded treasuries for several years at a large asset manager, institutional clients, trading treasuries, repo, Eurodollar futures, and treasury futures mainly. So that was where I really built my core competency, which is money markets and fixed income and US treasuries. And what goes into studying that, it's all of global macroeconomics, Fed watching, economy watching, and geopolitics. So all of it. And that's what I love to do, is be a global macroeconomic reader and thinker. And I used to be a reader, thinker, and trader. And after a certain point, got the opportunity to teach at my alma mater, USC, and teach fixed income there, and use that as an opportunity to change my career into an author. Now, halfway through the desk, I fell in love with Bitcoin. And that was its own process. But I was already a deep student of money. I was a money student and advocate. I was a gold holder, and so when I found Bitcoin, it was very natural for me to latch onto it as an idea. And I've been writing about Bitcoin ever since. And then, yes, I transitioned my career off of the desk. Now I have my own research firm, The Bitcoin Layer. I've written two books, Layered Money, and my new book here, which is called Bitcoin Age.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to do a deep dive into that book soon. But first, I'd like to pick your brain on a couple of things. That, like, you're coming from this macro world. And me, myself, I didn't get interested in economics at all until after Bitcoin. And I discovered Austrian economics, which all of a sudden, economics made sense, which it never did in school. Like I could never wrap my head around like any of the quote unquote social sciences, because to me they sounded like gibberish and like opinionated bullcrap. And mathematics and physics were they were much more my type of subject, because there was a right answer and a wrong answer. And it wasn't until I found Austrian economics that I had this holy shit moment where, you know, holy shit, economics is the same. You can actually like deduct irrefutable truths from a certain set of axioms. So what's your relationship with Austrian economics? And has it changed since you found Bitcoin? Is that why you became a gold bug in the first place? Like, what are your thoughts around that?
So the topic of economics is interesting for me personally, because while I did study economics in high school and university, and in my graduate program, I took economics classes throughout, I never found economics, either school of it, to be informative to me, because I am a market practitioner. So the only thing, in theory, that I care about is whether prices go up or down and why. And so when prices are going up or down, that's the signal. And so you can have one school of economics or the other, but if you're not interpreting the data to give you a sense of whether a price will go up or down, then you've missed the point. So while I've read Mises and Rothbard and Hayek and found them all to be much more sensical than the stuff I read in school, so that's my way of saying that I agree with that school of thought. The school of economic thought, basically Austrian economics prevails in the market, I guess, is something you could say, right? Because look at the price of gold and look at the price of Bitcoin. These two things are saying something about a referendum on Keynesian economics, I would say. And the whole episodes that we had during and after the pandemic goes to show you that inflation is a monetary phenomenon. So I'm more of the Milton Friedman school in terms of just a monetarist, someone who studies money and money's impact on things. So at my research firm, we're building around a new metric that we've designed called TBL liquidity. And that liquidity metric is a money metric. It's a measurement of the quantity and the velocity of money. And so I apologize for going a little off course, but in your question of do I agree with the Austrian school, I'm of the monetarist school and the practitioner of the market. And that's not really an economic theory. It's more of an observation. So maybe a different point in the science of this whole thing.
So your field of expertise is somewhat different.
That's correct. It's not economic. My field of expertise is not explaining the economics of how an economy operates with supply and demand and that school of thought. My expertise is in a market and in the money market, the market for money, which is deposits, cash, repo, treasuries, treasury bills, foreign currencies, gold, and Bitcoin, and whether those prices are going up or down relative to each other, whether the conditions are tight or easy, and how that all interacts with everything else in global macro.
Fantastic. We'll deep dive into that soon, but I love picking your brain on these nuances here, because recently I've been in debates with a lot of people back and forth about what money is and what relevance these terms have. So like in your mind, is money first and foremost a commodity or a credit system?
Sure. So today we operate in a credit system in which money, that is credit money, functions as money because it can, settle debts. And that's really what the definition of money is. Is it accepted? If it's accepted, it's money. And so today, credit money is accepted to settle debts. It's accepted in transactions, so it's money. There aren't commodity monies that are widely accepted as debt settlement. Even the Treasury Department can't send gold coins out to settle their treasuries. The system isn't set up like that. Now, from a qualitative perspective, from people on the ground, which is an equally important observation, people that are saving their money in gold and Bitcoin as a storage mechanism, are settling a debt with their future self by saving that money in gold and Bitcoin. So making gold and Bitcoin, you know, very much money-like, but not in the traditional sense of, you know, the monetary system per se. So monetary system, gold and Bitcoin don't really fit into it, but from everyday person's perspective, and now more and more in the practitioner's life, they are functioning as money. I would point out that GLD, the ETF, that, by the way, has now been surpassed in size. If you add IBIT and FBTC together, they're already bigger than GLD, the ETF, which is staggering. The GLD has been around a long time, but it just trades like a stock, meaning that this idea that you're transferring money to yourself in the future by holding a commodity is abstract for those people too. So Bitcoin and gold, which are commodities, are money by the definition of the people that have them. And even to many that hold gold and Bitcoin in the form of an ETF, they're not holding it as money. They're holding it as an investment within the dollar credit system. So both are true. I guess all three things are true to your question.
I'd say like the Austrians' devil's advocate to that would be that the very word money has been corrupted by credit money, and that commodity money is like the original use of the word money. When I wrote about it in the latest book, I tried to advocate for like the abandonment of the terms of the use of the term store of value. Because I think that the dichotomy between store of value and medium of exchange is false, because I think it's a medium of exchange over four dimensions, so over space and time. And store of value is really just you trading with your future self. So you can't store values and value, since value is subjective and dynamic to where you are in life, but you can trade with your future self. So I like to view it as a medium exchange over space and time. And the best definition I think I've seen of what money is Hans Hermann Hoppe's definition, which is it's simply the best available hedge against uncertainty, future uncertainty, and which is why like fiat is so corrupt, because it no longer functions as that, and people start using real estate and stocks and bonds and stuff instead of money as this hedge. And I think that has something to do with the mix-up that you think you can have medium exchange over space without first having it over time. So what are your thoughts when you hear that? Do you agree to it?
So that's my point about being a practitioner, is that that's your perspective from the market, and that's what you see. So you see that money is a commodity and that credit money has been corrupted. So you go toward the money that you feel is the best. And so for you, Bitcoin is money. And so that in the market then, which is where I observe, in the market, you've come and expressed that, and Bitcoin's price is up because you've expressed that view. So I observe that and I say, yes, there are people that are valuing this. And I believe that they've read Austrian economics and that they understand that credit money has been corrupted. So that's what my book Bitcoin Age is about. It's about the credit money system and how it's a mind trick on the public.
Let's talk Bitcoin security. I mean, the first thing you have to do, like this is the best practices stuff, right? You have to take your coins off an exchange. Everyone knows that. You have to take custody of your own Bitcoins. Well, that means holding your own private keys. The easiest way to do that is to get a hardware wallet so you can keep your coins offline. And we recommend this little thingy. It's called a Bitbox. You go to bitbox.swiss and use code Infinity for 5% off this thing. It's our favorite hardware wallet. It's very easy to use. It's good on privacy, and it's good for all kinds of other reasons too. And another thing that every Bitcoiner should do is write down their seed phrase. So usually when you fire up a hardware wallet, you get a seed phrase, 12 or 24 words that do not only represent your Bitcoin, they actually are your Bitcoin, these words. The 12 magic words are actually magic. And you could use a pen, but I don't advise people to ever use a pen, because if you use pen and paper and your house burns down or something, that paper is gone forever. For that reason, this thing has been invented many times by many companies. It's a metal seed plate. And this one is from our favorite seed plate manufacturer, Stamp Seed. You get this beautiful hammer and you can stamp your seed into this metal plate. And this particular one, you can do your own design here on the backside. This has no design on it, but there's a beautiful everything divided seed plate that you can get. If you use code Infinity, you get 15% off everything on their store. So stampseed.com, go there and figure out more. And if you want to buy what we call a shit ton of Bitcoin, you should probably secure them in a multi-sig solution of some kind that have like more professional custody. And for that, we recommend the bitcoinadvisor.com. This is a bunch of happy Australian people that are more than willing to help you and handhold you into Bitcoin multisig custody. One key is held by you, one by them, and one by a third party. And you need two out of the three keys to unlock your Bitcoin. This is for Bitcoin inheritance and for people who want to buy, yeah, a shit ton of Bitcoin. So secure your Bitcoin, go to Stampseed, go to Bitbox, go to the Bitcoin Advisor, and brush your teeth. Great. Then we get into that. That's perfect transition. So apart from that, what is the book about more? Like, what is that the main thesis of the book?
It opens actually with a scene from the Phantom Menace episode one of Star Wars. And it's a scene that a Jedi is trying to pay for parts for his spaceship, and he has Republic credits, and the mechanic doesn't accept the money. So he has to come up, you know, they have to, he used to wager on the race, and you know, later in the movie. But in that scene, the credits aren't good because you're on a distant planet and he doesn't recognize that, and he says, I need something more real. And then the Jedi tries to mind trick him, and it doesn't work on this creature. And he says, you know, what are you, a Jedi? Mind tricks won't work on me, only money. So it's an Austrian scene, you know, it's an Austrian scene itself is how I open the book. And now why does the mechanic not take the Republic credits, but everyone else in the world goes about and takes dollars? And that's what you're saying, that credit money is corrupted. Well, I hate to tell you, but there are billions of people that are just accepting them blindly every day for their precious time and labor. So I explain the origin of today's global banking dollar credit system in six steps in the book to explain to people what this dollar system is and how they have been mind tricked.
It's so great that it's that scene, because that's my favorite scene, not from the entire Star Wars movie, whatever. I'd call it a sixth trilogy because I don't count the Disney stuff. But from the first three, that is absolutely the first. It's the blue guy with the little wings, right?
That's
who
correct.
Owns Anakin. Yeah. No, it's great. So what's the... I guess the Jedi would be... The Jedi were actually politicians in the movie too. So like you could call them the mind trick, an actual mind trick. So what is the great Jedi mind trick that central bankers and bankers and politicians and whoever they are in this story that they've been able to pull off? Like, yes. What is the greatest mind trick?
The system, the credit system, requires perpetual expansion. The reason that it requires perpetual expansion is if you workshop the contraction, which we got a prime example in during the 1930s and the Great Depression, that the system collapses onto itself and then will die. So they built a political system and central banking system around themselves. And by they, I mean banks have built a system around themselves to protect against any contraction. So they guarantee expansion by controlling the world and instituting a system that allows them to do this, all in the name of, this is the way that we've built the system. And if it contracts for too long, it's bad. And so we must grow it. And again, I try to take the more of the market observer's route in. You watch the system. Anytime it contracts, the system is built to make it expand again. And so it's just a repeated observation of this process. And then what is the grand observation in terms of the price? Homes have gone from $25,000 to $420,000 since 1971. And incomes have gone from $9,000 to $80,000. So you only needed 2.5 years of income to afford a house 50 years ago. Now you need 5. So it's expanding in a disadvantageous way to the average American. And that system is built to enrich those that are closest to the system's expansion. And it works against everybody else that is observing this phenomenon of homes getting more expensive in terms of their labor or falling behind. So it's an explanation as to why that happens. And the key line to understand that in the book, which is that if credit money and the unlocking of it, which is a banking practice, so it's a bank that can create money or a central bank, but a bank that creates money, whoever is closest to the tap of the money can capture and benefit from the expansion of the system. And those that aren't even invited into the room are guaranteed to fall behind because prices will go up without them, not because of them. And so that dynamic needs to be explained. And I try to illustrate that very clearly to people to show them that the cards are indeed stacked against them for this specific reason of a global banking dollar system. It's not just an American dollar phenomenon. It's much more than that. And so I tell the story of the euro dollar as well, which is an important feature. And I'm only talking about here 3 of the 14 chapters, but we've talked about credit money to start. So I want to explain to people that 3 of the chapters early are fully dedicated to this explaining this credit money system. But yes, the book also explains the origin of Bitcoin, which requires the origin of the internet and the origin of applied cryptography or encryption. And so I tell both of those stories as well.
Yeah, it's funny, like speaking as a non-American, my ability to buy a house in America has like... you said two salaries as compared to 5 salaries.
For 2.5 probably, compared to 5. Yes.
For me, it's probably 50 salaries at this point, right? Because I'm simply not using the world's reserve currency because I'm further away from the monetary spigot.
That's correct.
And this is it's wonderful because this is about the Cantillon effect, which is, I think everyone in the world should be aware of. And it's something that all Bitcoiners are aware of and everyone else should be too. So in your mind, like this is harking back a bit to the Austrian versus Keynesianism or Austrian versus Chicago, whatever you may call it. Is inflation necessary for the economy to function?
It's necessary for the credit system to survive.
But not necessarily for a economic system to function.
Well, then we have the period of the gold standard to observe that it can work without that type of expansion or monetary inflation. So I believe that it is possible. Now, I don't project the demise of the credit system in my book because of how entrenched it is. So, you know, in a book, you have to choose the message that you're trying to get across. So I'm trying to illustrate a dynamic that works against people today and not try to project or promise them that it'll go away tomorrow because of Bitcoin, but rather Bitcoin can be a tool to empower them against this dynamic. And I try to show that empirically with numbers that the price of a house has fallen from 1,000 Bitcoin to 5 Bitcoin. And that is a very powerful image as well. So if Bitcoin can be an empowerment, a tool of empowerment, That's the message that I am trying to get across. Not necessarily that, hey, the whole system could survive without inflation. Because again, it gets to an economics debate.
Yeah, I guess it does. Also, the gold standard was not, gold is not finite the way Bitcoin is absolutely finite, right? So gold, so prices were stable on gold because the ability to find new gold had a parallel evolution to the ability to do everything else in society, I guess, is a way to put it. I think there's a cow priced in gold is the same now approximately as it was in the days of Mesopotamia, like 5,000 years ago, because finding new gold and making cows are equally more easy to pull off nowadays as back then. And I just find it fascinating to like imagine a future where prices cannot go up because it denominated in Bitcoin. It's such a mind fuck, for lack of a better word, because you have to like rethink everything in a society where all prices go down. But if you really ask yourself the simple question, the simple questions, it seems so obvious. Like if you practice doing something, do you get better or worse at doing that something? And the answer to that is obviously you probably get better. And so humans get better at doing stuff. And the follow-up question to that, I'd say, would be, so why aren't prices falling forever? And most people don't ask that follow-up question. And it never struck them that or that this could be the case. And I think
I actually talk about this exact thing in early in the book in chapter 2. I call it my Jeff Booth thesis, you know, that prices should fall actually as we get better at things. And so I fully agree with that concept. Now, what you're saying about, you know, a system in which prices fall, they can and are falling in Bitcoin, but we have a credit money system, so they rise denominated in that credit money because of its expansion. So I don't see the credit system going away, nor the dollar, and it can become even more expansionary than it ever has nominally into the future because of the relative power of the United States versus other countries. So there's a runway for the dollar and the credit money system that stretches far beyond my ability to see past.
But if, like, I love just trying to extrapolate these thought vectors as far as possible. So can the in your mind, can the dollar and Bitcoin coexist forever? Or is the dollar doomed to fail, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I believe that in the future, so in my book, I outline how I believe that the dollar and Bitcoin will coexist into the future. Now to go to the distant future, I believe that the dollar, in order to survive, and the credit system to survive alongside Bitcoin, without Bitcoin completely, basically, Bitcoin is it's an answer to. It's a way to measure the dollar and how weak the dollar is relative to money, right? Which is actually, I think, what we're talking about here, real commodity money. And so it is a disciplinary force in the future. Bitcoin is a disciplinary force on the dollar credit system if it wants to survive and coexist. And so I think that's the dichotomy in the future, that if that's goes back to the layered money thesis, that if the dollar wants to survive, it needs to be actually anchored in part by Bitcoin. And that's actually a state phenomenon, right? Only the national currency issuer can make that type of decision to hold, a hard money against their currency. So that's this hard money standard idea in the future, where it doesn't have to be a hard Bitcoin exchange rate where you can go and trade your dollars for Bitcoin at the treasury. It could, but it's more that the expansion of the credit money system should be regulated in some way, in some emergent way. And one of the ways it could do, a nation could do that, is by having Bitcoin on its balance sheet.
And do you think they will?
Well, what's interesting is that in the last 3 months, we've seen a speed of change in U.S. national policy that I've never witnessed before. And I'm not a grand historian of U.S. politics, let's say, right? I'm a casual observer of it, but in my lifetime, I've never seen anything like this. And I believe that all things are on the table. In fact, in the last couple days, I have more and more understood that this administration is trying to get a monetary reset and a new Bretton Woods agreement. So, yes. So this idea that I can't see a dollar and Bitcoin system, or that Bitcoin is a disciplinary force on the dollar, that I can't really see that because it might happen in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, could happen in 6 months out of nowhere, and it wouldn't even shock me because of the strategic Bitcoin reserve was signed a few weeks ago before the tariffs were launched. So what is that even? I mean, how do you even interpret that? It's really mind-bending. So how far is this, current political environment willing to go along that line? It's a question that I can't answer. So a bunch of I don't knows right now.
Yeah, I know, but what a time to be alive, right?
Yes.
So yeah, I have a few thoughts around all of this stuff. And first of all, they usually call the fiat system that every politician is just kicking the can down the road. But I would say it's more akin to rolling the snowball down the hill, because it's picking up even more and more debt exponentially, right? Because the whole thing is that there's never enough money in the system to repay all the debt, because of the interest has to be paid back with credit money that does not exist, but require even more credit money to come into being. And this is why this is such an unstoppable force, and why it's so inevitable that fiat currencies have to die at some point, because it's as you say, it requires forever expansion, and that just can't happen.
Now, hear me out 1 second. Let me explain a potential thing that can happen. Now, I'm not projecting this, but this is something that I think about right now. The U.S. has a big trade deficit, so we export dollars. Then the foreigners buy U.S. treasuries. So there's this huge capital surplus and a huge current account deficit. And that's because we basically import things into the United States and export the dollars. Now, if we start making some of the stuff in the United States, and or you start exporting more weapons, basically is one of the things that it sounds like the administration wants to do, just export weapons to the rest of the world, you reduce the amount of dollar stock abroad. So you can, in theory, reduce the amount of debt held by countries outside of the United States. That will reduce the debt on aggregate, and the treasuries go away. The U.S. government deleverages, but the other side of the deleveraging trade from the U.S. government is not that money goes away from the onshore system, but that the offshore storage tool of the United States government used by foreign governments goes away, and that's the result of the deleveraging. So in that scenario, you could get a stronger U.S. fiscal picture, less debt, falling debt to GDP, without a destruction of the onshore credit creation system, which is instituted by banks. You actually try to spur that on with banking deregulation, which they're trying to do also. So there's a scenario where the United States debt stock falls, the debt to GDP falls, and the health of the United States and the dollar system is not just kicked the can down the road, but you've actually repaired some of the problem. I believe that that is possible and something that I'm actively watching for in my ongoing research.
And is this a win-win thing, though, or is it at the expense of other countries that getting rugged?
Oh, yes, because if they can't use the dollar in the same way that they do. So one of the things that the administration is saying is that if China and Brazil are trading with each other in dollars, we're giving them a free gift, basically, as a country. We're giving them a free tool to use with benefiting the two countries.
Well, this benefits the US too, right?
Well, that's what they're saying, is that there is a limit to the benefit, or there is a price to pay for it. And that's really what they're saying about the weapons, is that if you want to use the dollar in your trade, you have to pay for that good. It's good for us, but we want to extract something out of it. And so that's a political play. That's a political play. And that is the potential policy action. When we talk about the export of weapons, what you're doing is you're physically reducing the trade deficit. So that's one of the things that I'm watching for.
To me, it sounds like more like something a bank would do than a nation state. Well, not that I have the highest thoughts about nation states, but it sounds like, okay, so you decouple the dollar from gold so that you could print greenbacks and pay for everything with them. So you sent the rest of the world green paper and you got oil in return and stuff. And all of a sudden, I'm saying you now, but I don't mean you personally. I mean, this is what the US did, of course, in terms of foreign policy. So you've been paying for everything with fiduciary media for at least since the 70s. And now you want to charge people for it too, for using that kind of money? Is that
no? It's actually an answer to the Eurodollar system. So the Eurodollar system emerged outside of the United States and instituted by banks outside of the United States, and they created a bunch of currency, and they created the currency to trade oil with each other, and so that whole system exists because the U.S. Federal Reserve observed it in the late 50s and eventually allowed it, and then participated in the backstopping of it in the 1970s. I tell all of these stories in my book, Bitcoin Age. They're very, very important because they illustrate that the global banking cartel creating these dollars is actually taking advantage of the US currency, which is it's a US dollar in name only. It's not a US dollar. It's a global banking dollar. And that's an important distinction.
Yeah. So that's very clear to see that the American people doesn't necessarily benefit from the dollar being the thing or the global reserve currency. Like to begin with, you don't see the little guy in the US benefiting very much from that. As you said before, you need 5 salaries instead of 2 to buy a house. So it hasn't benefited normal people. Hello there. I'm Knut Svanholm, and I'm an international village idiot and author. These are my books on Bitcoin. Bitcoin Sovereignty Through Mathematics, Bitcoin Independence Reimagined, Bitcoin Everything Divided by 21 Million, and Bitcoin The Inverse of Clown World. These are now re-edited, redesigned, and available from the Bitcoin Infinity Store. I mean, look at that. Look at how your collection could look. It's upside down. But there they are anyway. But more than that, all of these books will be released for free, chapter by chapter, week by week on Noster. Also accompanied by a video that Luke and I will make talking about the ideas in the book, where we answer your questions, because you can sign up for the Bitcoin Infinity Academy and join courses for each and every one of the books and talk to us every now and then and get other perks like a free set of steak knives. So go to the Bitcoin Infinity store right now, get the books, sign up for the academy.
The steak knives is only a maybe.
Oh, all right then. Do you see Bitcoin fixing this for nation states? Because yeah, this is where I was going before with the snowball analogy. So I'd say like the US having a reserve, you can have your opinions on that. I think mine is like, I would have preferred for regular people to be able to stockpile as much Bitcoin as possible before the whole nation state game theory thing started. But it is what it is. At least number go up. I guess that's good. But wouldn't the US have to tie Bitcoin to the actual dollar and like have something like a redeemability thing going for it to actually be able to save the dollar if Bitcoin plays a part in how the dollar survives?
Yeah. So that is based on the premise that the dollar is not surviving. The dollar is the one of the strongest relative to other currencies that it has been in many years, but the dollar system itself is growing in power relative to other currencies. Now, gold and Bitcoin, yes, are they reflecting that the underlying measurement of the dollar versus commodity money is going down. But the dollar system versus other currencies is getting stronger. And I actually believe that many fiat currencies will die and go away in a new monetary system. So I believe that the dollar system itself is getting stronger versus its peers. And so why would the US need to institute any redeemability? That only makes the strategic Bitcoin reserve subject to foreign withdrawal. And that doesn't make any sense.
I guess it's because I view it from, I'm so used to viewing the dollar from a Bitcoiner lens. Like I have just seen the dollar plummet in terms of Bitcoin because I use Bitcoin as my main unit of account. And I just see these other currencies, including the dollar, collapse. So I don't see why in the long run, anyone would choose to use that when you have something that is so much better. I guess that's the simplest way to ask the question.
Listen, I believe in Bitcoin. I think the same amount that you do in its power to protect yourself from this system that we're describing. But I think that I have a much longer lifeline in my mind for the current system and for people and institutions and nation states to continue to use it, you know, into perpetuity. So I don't see this like disintegration of the system because people are suddenly enlightened by Bitcoin. The states themselves have their own problems to solve, and currency is one of their main tools that they use, and trade and debt and debt financing, and that's just the way that governments operate. So I just don't see that system going away, or for them having to all of a sudden say that, oh, we're going to unfiat the system.
Now, to be clear here, I don't see that in any short-term future either. When I'm speaking about short-term, I usually mean a couple of hundred years. Okay. But I've noticed that most people don't think that way about time. Like so, but I do think that Bitcoin, if it just keeps functioning, it will inevitably take over. And that may take a couple of hundred years. But at the end of the day, all the fiat currencies are doomed. From someone who's been in Bitcoin for over a decade now, and I've seen these shitcoin exchanges, you know, and that whole phase in 2017 when people were trading between shitcoins, and now there are all these in fiat land, there are fintech tools like Revolut or Wise or something like that, where you can have a plethora of fiat currencies in the same wallet. And same thing there, you can trade one for the other. But you just know as a Bitcoiner that I better put everything in dollars because that's the best thing I have in this shitcoin wallet here. But it's just the same phenomenon. Once you've passed the Bitcoin threshold, so to speak, and seen what Bitcoin is and like how these things function and play out, it's just like any other shitcoin casino. You see, like, why should I have anything allocated to any of these shitcoins? Why do I need a Czech corona or a Swedish krona for that matter, or an Indian rupee or whatever? What are they good for except for maybe the odd holiday every here and there? That, like, this is obvious. There's one winner, but just as obvious as the dollar is as the winner of the fiat race, I think it's even more obvious that Bitcoin is the winner of the crypto race, but also that it's obvious that Bitcoin is the winner against the dollar in the long run, if you just compare them through the same lens, so to speak. I don't really know where I'm going with that, but what love to hear your thoughts, though.
I mean, you know, I agree with you from a theoretical perspective, but Bitcoin is $1.5 trillion in market cap. Gold is $20 trillion. So it has a long way to go just to catch up to the current number one commodity money. So it's still very early. It's not, I mean, and if your time horizon is, 100 years, I mean, kudos to you, because I can't think about that type of time horizon. I can think about, my daughter is 7. So I'm thinking in terms of as she grows up and as I grow old. And in that time, you know, which is, you know, like, let's call it 20 to 30 years as I'm trying to plan for the future for my life and my family. I'm thinking the credit system survives. The United States remains very strong globally. The dollar system survives. Banks keep their credit system going, expanding. And I want my family to be thinking about their time and labor in terms of Bitcoin. And that's the way I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think about things that way too, of course. I do, however, think that to a certain extent, that is part of what made the credit system emerge, is that people they think about their own lifespan and they don't necessarily think generationally. And if fiat, once it started, it sort of made everyone's, you know, time preference higher, as we love to talk about the time preference in the Bitcoin space. And therefore, people have even shorter time horizons. And I think when you introduce something like Bitcoin, that is like, it's hard to make sense of it if you don't think over a very long time span, like with all the halvings and what happens after the year 2140 and all of that. Like, you have to take all of these things into consideration, while you don't have to do that with the dollar. Anyway, are we still on chapter 3 of the book? Do we have 10 chapters to go? How far into the book are we, like, discussion-wise?
Well, because we've jumped around talking about Bitcoin, I think a lot of the Bitcoin chapters, try to explain Bitcoin from the emergent value of it. So the fact that it is a decentralized scarce currency, and that was understood early and then built on itself over time. So a lot of the Bitcoin chapters are dedicated to where the value comes from, and that value comes from the decentralization and the story behind it. So I tell really great story about the origin of the internet's core protocol, TCP, IP, and where that came from, starting in the ARPANET in the US Defense Department, and the ideas and the heroes around that. And then the origins of public key cryptography, which also is a fascinating story that comes from deep down inside the NSA, Again, another U.S. government agency. So some really fascinating stories about the origins of the internet, the cypherpunks, their earliest meetings on the beaches of Santa Barbara in California, the crypto conferences of 1981 and 1982. And then, yeah, I tell a brief story also about the United States government recognizing Bitcoin as part of the First Amendment. And that is something that I believe adds another subset of society to the potential owners and people that recognize Bitcoin for its value. I think that's a very strong force. United States government is a very powerful force in this world. And for it to endorse Bitcoin endorse and understand Bitcoin in a choppy, haphazard, but still clear string of events from 2013 to 2025. Those events are part of Bitcoin's history as well. It's a late chapter in the book, but the United States government is an important force in the lasting of Bitcoin, just as they were in the founding of the internet. They were the, instrumental actor. If we think about the Defense Department, the instrumental actor of networking computers together. And so there's a strong connection between Bitcoin and the United States. And I think that connection runs through the First Amendment. It runs through the decentralization of powers and freedom. And those are all messages that I tried to close the book with.
Those are beautiful messages. So in your mind, is Bitcoin unstoppable? Or does it depend on things like the U.S. government, or is it truly unstoppable?
Well, it's co-opted the government. That's the point here. The government is a representation of the electorate. So the American people that are Bitcoiners have co-opted the U.S. government. It's phenomenal to see. And so Bitcoin is unstoppable from that perspective, because look at what Bitcoin has done. It's taken over in terms of allowing itself to exist and thrive, coded by U.S. law. That's not the government endorsing. The U.S. government is a representative government. And call me naive for saying that, but it is a representative government. That's how it's structured. And so I believe it represents today the will of the people who are Bitcoiners that say, let me use my Bitcoin, let me hold my Bitcoin. It's not even let me, it's I'm doing it. And so a Republican form of government protects the individual and his rights against the invasion of his privacy, as long as he's not doing harm onto others. And so the American person is doing it. He and she are being Bitcoiners. So in that process, they've encoded into law what they already have done. And I try to express that message that Hal Finney becoming the first Bitcoiner and saying, yes, that is the American government in theory starting its first step towards encoding Bitcoin into law, because part of the First Amendment, it's a freedom technology. And it's built into the First Amendment. And so it's not about the government, U.S. government allowing or Bitcoin taking over. It's taken over. It's the Bitcoin age. We are already in it. The Bitcoin age, I say that it starts somewhere in 2016. I believe it started many years ago. And we're already living in the Bitcoin age today.
That's a beautiful note to end on here. I know you're short on time, but before we wrap this up, I mean that was just gave me goosebumps, that rant. And maybe I'm a bit too black-pilled when it comes to democratic systems in general, but I think Bitcoin is it's the it's the First Amendment put into action. So now it's not just something on a piece of paper anymore. It's actually a thing that materializes in the world. It's people using their inherent right to express themselves and not giving a shit what anyone else thinks about it. And I think that's a beautiful, just beautiful to see and very hopeful. My hope is that the next political wave is that countries start dropping any capital gains tax on Bitcoin so that it can actually be used as a medium exchange, not only over time, but over space. And as a medium exchange, as people usually define the term. So do you think maybe that's the last question here? Like, do you think that will happen in the US anytime soon, that they will drop the capital gains tax?
I am starting to, and the speed at which this government is moving is a little bit blinding. So it's hard to see, but I actually thought about this yesterday, that capital gains tax could be ending, because it unlocks the administration is using the word unlock a lot when they're talking about things. So when you talk about unlocking Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, boom, no capital gains tax, and then you unlock the activity, and all of that economic activity has the ability to accrue to the people that are using it and their governments by that same way, even if they're not collecting capital gains tax, because the activity is done within the domicile. So yes, it's possible. And yes, it's something that I've started to think a lot about.
Great. Well, I certainly hope that that is the case, and it sets a precedent for every other country in the world to do the same. Bitcoin is speech. It's a communications network. First and foremost, we signal value to one another. At the end of the day, it's just ones and zeros. So it should be protected by the First Amendment, which should be applicable to all humans of all ages and all countries. Like, we should all be able to express ourselves. That it's a basic human right, I think. Like, the right to be left alone is the underlying right. Well, I'm ranting on here. Anyway, anywhere on the internet you want to send our listeners before we wrap up here?
They can find everything we're doing at thebitcoinlayer.com. At thebitcoinlayer.com, you can find links to my book. You can find links to our show, our channel, our TBL Pro subscription for those that are looking for more of a quantitative research experience in global macroeconomics. So you can find everything that we're doing at thebitcoinlayer.com.
And anywhere where you can see Nick live anytime in the future at one of the conferences or so?
I'm speaking in Vegas. So
in Vegas.
Hope All right. to see some of you there.
No chance you're coming to Europe anytime soon?
I'm actually trying to workshop opportunities to help, you know, sign books and talk about my book all around the world. But, you know, it's tough to travel internationally with students and a family and, you know, a channel. So I have to pick my spots.
I know the problem. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on, Nick. This has been a great conversation, I think. I wish I had 2 more hours to pick your brain, but we'll have to do it again sometime.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, and hope to see you offline sometime soon, too. So, well, I should say this has been the Bitcoin Infinity Show. Thanks for listening.